Please go ahead. This afternoon's conference call is now being recorded.
Thank you very much. Okay, hello everybody, and welcome to this IRTP call today on the 26th of April. On the call, we have James Bladel, Mike O'Connor, Chris Chaplow, Barbara Steele, Barry Cobb, Matt Serlin, Bob Mountain, and from staff, Christina Nordstrom, and apologies from Paul Diaz, Anil George, Kevin Erdman, and Simonetta Batikir. Did I miss anyone?
I don't think so. Thank you.
Okay. So can I please also remind you to please state your names before speaking for transcript purposes, and that's it. Over to the chair.
All right. Thank you, Christina. Sorry about the delay with this, as we had, or I had, technical difficulties which involved me being connected to some random presentation by some other company who I've never heard of, and I'm not even too sure what they were giving a presentation about. As per usual, does anybody have any updates to their statement of interest, declaration of interest? Nobody's declared that they're a communist or anything in my in the last week? No? Okay. Right, moving on. Okay, then. Okay, we have the comments up there in front of us, and we also have some updates in terms of the emergency action channel from Mikey and James. Mikey, you sent that out to the entire list, didn't you?
Yeah, and I just sent PDFs too because Chris was having trouble opening my Word document. Sorry about that.
Okay, I see that. That's perfect because that way I can actually see this immediately. I'll go look in my inbox. Okay, so Christina, could you just put that up on the screen, please?
Yes, absolutely.
Thanks.
Just 1 second.
That's okay. Okay, so we have... Okay, thank you. Mikey, do you want to just walk us through this quickly, or shall I just go through it quickly? I don't really mind.
Go ahead.
Right, well, there isn't anything really significantly changed, as far as I can tell, from the last one. We just kind of cleaned a couple of things up. So we've got there that we've reduced the response time down to 4 hours from 24. Both parties will retain documentation in written or electronic form. Oh, sorry, just 1 second. How do I get this thing... I'm afraid I can't take this on my channel call.
Kaylee's having a tough day today.
Oh, I'm having a terribly tough day. I'm going to turn that thing off. I don't know what the hell's going on. Sorry, this is... Like, I hardly ever get any actual phone calls, but when I do, they all seem to come together. Sorry, right. Let me show that now. Of course, my phone now won't turn itself off. Right, and that was about it, really. That was the only other two made, or am I missing something?
No, that was it.
Okay, and you've also put together a little FAQ, which I think is probably the thing we're going to have the most discussion around, I think. So, EAC FAQ. Oh, dear God, it's acronym hell. Okay, what is the EAC? What is it for? The Emergency Action Channel is a mechanism to facilitate urgent communications relating to transfers. The goal of the EAC is to quickly establish real-time communication between registrar representatives who can take steps to resolving the issue, but this policy only addresses establishing that communication, not resolving any disputes that may arise. Okay, any problems or any feedback, please, people, you know, get in there, give feedback. Actually, Christina, could you pop up the FAQ document now, please, if you don't mind? Sorry, Christina.
Yes.
It's the second.
Is that the one we had before, or
the
FAQ document?
Yes, please.
Okay.
I think most people on the call have it anyway, but just just for the sake of sanity. Okay, so what's the scope of the EAC? The EAC only addresses the need to establish communications between registrars in emergency situations. The EAC requirements outlined in this policy consciously exclude all aspects of resolving any disputes that may arise between parties in order not to disrupt processes that already exist to do that. The EAC is limited to main transfer emergencies at this time, although other PDPs may expand the scope in the future. Bob, go ahead.
Maybe getting too picky, it seems to me by when we say establishing communication, we're really talking about the initial communication around quick action if necessary, but further communication, is that likely to be ongoing in terms of a dispute between the gaining and losing registrar, or is that likely to be held between other parties?
That's out of scope, really.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if, you know, again, maybe just too picky, but would it be establishing preliminary communication or qualify that somewhat just to make it more specific, or is that just too nitpicky?
I think it's a valid point. Mikey?
Yes, sir.
Oh, great one. Are you?
I'm actually inclined to sort of put that in the too nitpicky column.
Okay.
Because as soon as we get into that, then we have to define preliminary and, sheesh, I don't know. What I was trying to do with this was sort of, this is not a policy document. This is more of a document that I thought we would send out to our constituencies introducing it. And so I was a little bit looser in the language. And a little bit more repetitive in this one, but I'd certainly go with the will of the group on this. I don't feel real strongly about it.
Bob, the fact that it says establish, doesn't that suggest that it's the initial?
It's just the duration of the communication was my question. You know, you are establishing, but is it communication? I just wanted to – the only thought that occurred to me is we might want to put some messaging in there that time boundary, which I think Mikey has endeavored to do. But I'm just wondering is if on this communication we want to just make it really clear that it's only for this initial period where, you know, the action needs to be taken, you know, immediately. And then further communication might not, you know – might not be a direct result of that. It might be in the form of a dispute resolution, which would be different, so.
Bob, would you accept that this covers the initial communication, establishing communication, and starting a dialogue with somebody?
Yes.
Okay. Do you need... Do you feel that we need to go beyond that? I'm trying to understand what the problem is that you're trying to solve. I'm a bit confused.
Again, it's a fine point, but not a hill to die on. But the
well, I mean, if you want to die, that's fine. But I'm not feeling particularly suicidal this afternoon. But anyway, go ahead.
Me neither. It's too early in the week. Establishing that communication. This policy only addresses establishing that communication, not resolving any disputes that might arrive. So the only thing I was saying was to qualify that communication a little bit further, that initial communication, comma, not resolving any disputes that may arrive. That would be my suggestion, but again, I'm
okay, could you ping that to the list, please, so that we can just capture that nicely? So I see you're just rejigging the way it's worded slightly.
Yes.
All right. Could you ping that for this, please?
By email or in the chat box?
No, by email.
I've got it.
Oh. Okay, Mikey's got it. Okay, fine. It's just the main thing is just making sure we capture it. Okay. Does anybody else have any comments on the first two parts of this? No? Okay. next bit. What happens when the gaining registrar does not respond to an EAC request? The losing registrar informs the registry that they have not received a response to their EAC request, and the registry performs a transfer undo in accordance with Section 6 of the existing IRTP. Any thoughts on that? No? Okay. The only possible suggestion... okay. James, go ahead.
I know we've discussed this, and I want to, and I realize I'm looking at the FAQ document here and not the actual language that will be inserted into the IRTP policy, but have we considered how the registry will determine whether or not the gaining registrar, the losing registrar needs to prove that the gaining registrar did not respond when the gaining registrar claims that it did. I'm seeing transfer undos happen in spite of responses to EACs is the scenario I'm picturing. And so I may be asking if the language here is correct or if we need some additional guidance here, perhaps from Barbara.
So what you're saying is there's nothing here that allows for the gaining registrar to turn around to the registry and go, well, actually, we did reply. Is that correct, James?
Right, and I don't want to turn this into a dispute, but I mean, I think that I'm hoping that the registry just doesn't take the claim on faith. I hope that they're asking to see some, maybe they contact the gaining registrar, EAC, or something to verify that they did not respond. I guess what I'm seeing here is losing registrar says, hello, emergency action channel. The gaining registrar says, yes, can I help you? And then the losing registrar says, no, transfer undues. And that the, you know, I understand we're putting the registry in a position here of adjudicating whether that happened or not, but it's a concern that I have that this has the potential to be abused.
Okay. Barbara, thoughts?
Yeah, this is Barbara. I think that probably what we'd want to do is to have some sort of a standardized form that they would have to submit the losing registrar if they're asking for us to do a transfer undo as a result. And I think that we probably, and I don't know, you all can let me know what you think about this, as the registries, it makes sense for us to, you know, do a reach out as well to whoever it was that the losing registrar had contacted and maybe give them, you know, 2 hours to say, wait a minute, we did respond. Any thoughts on that from the rest of the folks?
So just to clarify then, that would mean that our initial four-hour window plus 2 hours after you've been contacted to undo the transfer.
Right. I do understand that it is expanding that window a bit, but I just think that...
Barbara, I'm not criticizing. I'm just simply trying to put this out in, you know, just concisely. So we have an existing 4 hours... So allowing, obviously, you need a certain amount of time for them to come back to you. So you're talking 4 plus 2. James, go ahead.
Yes, I like Barbara's idea. I think one modification without expanding the time would be that the request to the EAC, you know, could somehow simultaneously be made or the registry could be notified that an EAC request was sent. So that the registry could have some sort of, you know, objective perspective, and it wouldn't be just a he said, she said type situation. The other thought would be that when the registry is going to implement an undo, that they copy or notify the EAC contact again. Now, this is coming from the registry to say, you know, it's been, you know, you didn't respond to this EAC from Registrar X. We're going to undo this transfer. You know, you have... In Barbara's example, you have 2 hours to respond to block this implementation. But, you know, I understand it's giving them a second chance, and I understand we don't want to do that. But I think a non-responsive registrar is a non-responsive registrar, and they're not going to respond to 4 hours from the registrar or 2 hours from the registry. The thing that I'm trying to prevent against is claims of non-response that automatically flow into transfer undues when they're not warranted. Thanks.
Barbara, thoughts?
Yeah, this is Barbara. I think that you're making a very good point there, James. Maybe what we also do is require that they come in via email and that the EAC for whoever's currently managing the name, I guess it would be the gaming registrar in this case, is copied on that particular email and just so that they're aware that there has been a request put into the registry to do a transfer undo. And then, maybe you shorten the window. I think that there should be some opportunity for them to say, wait a minute, we did respond. So, I would say you shorten the window even, 30 minutes to an hour.
Mikey?
Another way to do this would be to have the gaining registrar reply simultaneously to the registry and the losing registrar so that the registry would be essentially part of the back and forth dialogue.
There's just one problem, Mikey, just cutting across here. While VeriSign are capable of using email and most of the other registries are capable of using email, there is at least one GTLD registry that is incapable of using email.
Okay.
And I wish I was
just
making
never
this
mind.
Up. I wish I was making this up. They will send you an email notifying you of something, and if you try to reply to that email, it will go into a black hole because they're incapable of actually parsing email. Sorry.
Well,
had to be said.
Okay. Anyway, just to chime in, I think this is Mikey again. I think that James is on to something, and that we should try and nail this down because we certainly don't want to have a malicious registrar using this to claw back domain names, which is, I think, the scenario
Mikey,
that you're
James.
Describing. Yeah.
And the benefit of, for the purposes of managing our time efficiently, I will take this as well as the broader concept of EAC abuse to the mailing list and propose some optional draft language, and I would definitely welcome some help from you or from Barbara.
Cool.
I don't want to go down the path where, we have a really good idea for a improvement to the policy here, but we're stuck on the margins of how it can be abused. I think, solving all these problems in advance is what causes us to not come up with policies at all. So let me work on this. Let me, take it offline if that's okay with you guys. But I just wanted to point out that at this point I'm more concerned about, I think we've nailed down the EAC function. Now I'm looking at EAC abuse, and I'll take that offline.
Okay, so James, will you better come back to us next week with some updates on this or kind of follow up by email on the list?
Yes, sooner than that even. I will be on the list probably by end of day, Thursday, U.S. time.
Of this week?
Correct.
Okay, that's fine. Okay, then. Right, sorry. Okay, just moving.
Michaela,
go ahead,
this is Mikey. Just to preserve our time, I don't know how many folks have actually had a chance to read this document. It came pretty late yesterday, and it might be, rather than pick the whole call going through this again, is to have people really scrub this on the list and so we can get on to some of the other stuff. Just a thought. Either way is fine with me.
Well, I'm going to run through this quite quickly because I know that not everybody will have read this. James?
Yes, I was just going to second what Mikey said, because I found a couple of areas in our report outside of EAC which probably also need some polishing. And I didn't want, EAC to consume all of our time between now and Singapore, so I just wanted to get in the queue or get on future agendas with some other odds and ends.
No, it's fine. I'm just going to run through this very, very quickly. So I think just make sure if there's anything obvious that people have missed out, okay? Policy requires a four-hour response time. Isn't that going to be hard for smaller registrars to cover, especially at night or on the weekends? No, even the smallest registrars can rotate this function among operational staff. just as they rotate other emergency aspects of their business. The number of EAC requests is likely to be very small and quite infrequent, but when they occur, there is a genuine emergency that needs to be dealt with quickly. Who can use the EAC? Okay, the EAC is with registrars, registries, I can staff. Okay, this is an important one. Can the EAC be used to initiate urgent but not emergency communications? Obviously no, and it goes into some detail there. Can registrants use the EAC? No, the EAC is only available to registrars, registries, and ICANN staff. Do we need to expand on that one? Because obviously the question is going to be, if I'm a registrant who's affected, how they raise this. Matt Serlin, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Yeah, I had that exact thought, actually, that I do think we should expand on that just to give people a little bit more information about what steps a registrant can take. You know, first contact your registrar. If they're not responsive, you know, contact ICANN or whatever it is. But, no, I agree with you. I think we do need to expand it.
James, then Barbara.
Agreeing with Matt, I would suggest we say something like, can registrants use the EAC, and then say the EAC is reserved for registrars, registries, and ICANN staff. Contact your registrar support and notify them that you have an emergency transfer issue, and if they're not responsive, then, you know, possibly lodge a complaint with ICANN.
This is Barbara. Okay. I don't really have anything more to add to that. I agree wholeheartedly with that approach.
This is Mikey. I had language sort of like that a couple of more questions down. What escalation options does a registrant have? If you take a look at that, is that close enough? Can I just combine these two?
I think you should combine them.
Yep. Unless you wanted to change the name of this one to who can use the EAC as opposed to can registrants use the EAC.
That's very neat.
Yeah, and maybe what I'll do is I'll pull them a little closer together so that...
I'd put the escalation options right after that question.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Now, what is the definition of emergency in this context? The full sentences would be helpful. In order to qualify as an EAC emergency, the issue has to be a serious, unexpected, and harmful situation related to a domain transfer. Does anybody feel that that needs to be expanded upon or anything? I've got other people. I don't know whether this is related to this or to other matters. Chris, then Bob, then James.
Thanks, Michele. Chris here. It's just other matters. I just think we need to be quite specific about which registrar, because it depends how and when you're reading it. So when we're saying their registrar, because my understanding is we want the registrant to go to the, inverted commas, losing registrar and not start talking to both registrars at the same time. Isn't that right? So we need, you know, who you thought was your registrar, who you've got as the original registrar. It was just that comment
okay.
To clarify the language at all points.
All right. Okay. Bob?
Yeah, this is Bob. This is on the definition of emergency. I thought that it would be good to expand that, potentially with even some examples of what might be a legitimate emergency.
Okay, so for example...
The domain is hijacked, and the registrant needs to follow up immediately with the registrar would be one example. It was an inadvertent transfer. Might be another emergency.
How is an inadvertent transfer an emergency? Explain that one to me, please.
If it's a domain that's generating revenue and the transfer of the domain has caused that revenue to, you know, to stop, then that would be an emergency for me as the registrant.
You know, but how is it not? Okay, that part I understand. I'm having an issue with you saying that an inadvertent transfer is an emergency.
Well, you might not know what that is. As the registrant, that might appear
okay.
to you.
Okay, I'll rephrase it to you this way. In my own personal narrow view of this, if somebody hacks into somewhere, into a system, and is able to compromise my domain and be able, and basically hijack it, steal it from me, I view that as being an emergency. Mm-hmm. If I screw up and have the temp secretary who I only hired last week having full access to manage my domain names, and she accidentally screws up, I wouldn't see that as being the same kind of emergency. But that's just me.
No, I was saying the transfer, the inadvertent transfer, was not the registrant. It was perhaps the registrar that did it, so it would appear for the registrant to be a hijacking, whereas it was actually a not that. At any rate, it's not. You know, those may not be the best. Those may not be the best examples. But I was just, my point was that it would be good to have a couple of legitimate examples here, I think, that would you know, just sort of flesh out what we're you know, the point that we're trying to make here.
Okay,
so Kelly, this is James. I think I might be able to help here.
Please.
I hope so, Bob. You can smack me next time if I'm off space here, but I think what's missing in this definition of emergency is an acknowledgement of the timeliness, where a timely response is required, where the harm is compounded as the time elapses. So I think that, you know, in a generic sense, whether we're talking about a hijacking, whether we're talking about fraud, whether we're talking about an error, or an operational problem, or maybe a script that went haywire and started transferring a bunch of names it shouldn't have done. Whatever the condition, I think what we're saying here is EAC is reserved for things where the harm is a factor or a function of the time that elapses and the speediness by which we can get this back.
Okay. Anybody else have any thoughts on that? Okay,
Yeah, Michael, I just tend to agree, because you don't know the cause of the problem at the time. Like with your fire example, you don't know whether it's arson or whether you left a cigarette in the ashtray, but it's certainly an emergency when the office gets catched on fire.
Oh, I agree. Okay, then, can we... Mikey, did you manage to capture some of that?
Oh, MP3s are a wonderful thing. No worries.
Okay. All right, then. What happens if a registrar abuses the EAC? Same thing happens if a registrar violates any ICANN consensus policy. This is a question that's outside the scope of the IRTP working group. Okay. Any comments on that?
Just that this is James, and just that I will take that to the list.
Okay, perfect. What escalation options does the registrant have with regard to hijacking? Where does the EAC fit in? So this is kind of what we were looking at previously. First and best source of help for a registrant whose domain has been hijacked is their registrar. The EAC is aimed at helping that registrar quickly get in touch with the gaining registrar so they can resolve the issue quickly, or quickly so there's a dispute that needs to be escalated to a higher level for resolution. In the event that the registrars cannot resolve the situation, and James, stop telling fibs, so it's outside of the situation, the registrant can then move on to the other existing dispute resolution processes through the courts, ICANN compliance, and or the transfer dispute resolution policy. Transfer dispute policy. Okay. Any quick comments on that? On the escalations? No? Okay, moving on. How long is the time frame that the EAC is available after an incident or problem is identified? And here is the thing that I think we could have queries about. This time frame is consciously not defined for several reasons. The primary reason is that by not specifying availability, we avoid providing a roadmap for hijackers to time their activities. But another reason why this is not defined in the policy is the ease with which the threat of a transfer undo can be avoided by the gaining registrar. They simply get in contact with the losing registrar, and the requirements of the EAC are fulfilled. Now, girls and boys, does anybody have any issues or queries or suggestions or anything to do with the FAQ? Matt Serlin, I will pick on you, since it's Tuesday.
Yeah, great, thanks.
You're welcome.
Do I personally have a problem with it, or do I think we as a group will receive issues?
Either or. I really don't care who's having the problem, or just as long as we find out what the problem is. And
no, I don't have a problem with the language. Do I think others will have a problem with it? Yes. But I don't think that should stop us from presenting it in this form. But that's just my opinion. No, I think it's actually perfectly worded, and it makes sense, frankly. So unless others disagree, I wouldn't suggest changing it.
Okay. Does anybody have any other thoughts on this? Okay, James and then Bob.
Okay, this is James speaking, and I have a very strange but possibly creatively insane idea, which is that we have discussed some of the potential issues with EAC, but I think everyone agrees that on balance it's a good idea and it's a good practice for registrars. But we have some hesitation because of these marginal issues that we've identified. So knowing that, and knowing that we are spending approximately 12 months per IRTP iteration, and we're on B and we have to go through E, one of the ideas might be to revisit EAC in the last IRTP PVP, which I think would be E, and just see if there's any problems that have been uncovered in implementation or use, and possibly just issue some clarifications or modifications at that time, and just put a place marker down for IRTPE to see how this is working out, because it'll be about a year and a half to 2 years on. Thanks.
Okay. Anybody else have any thoughts on this?
This is Mikey. I don't know that people can see my little agreement check mark because of the way the Adobe's set up, but I think that's a great idea. I actually had that idea myself, but I couldn't figure out how to implement it. But I think James's approach is right on.
Okay, Bob, and then Barbara.
Yeah, this is Bob. I guess I may have missed this previously, but the last paragraph in the FAQ, just a question, is there no limit on when EAC can be activated after a domain transfer?
That's correct. There's no limit.
So it could be years after the event?
Right.
Okay. I think I didn't realize that, so my apologies if I missed that before. That was something we had a lot of strong feedback previously, was just the excessive length of time that one could do the clawback. So I suspect if there's no time limit, we're going to get similar feedback on that one. Now maybe we just go out there and wait to get it. But we did. Yep.
Did you see the little bit about? There's two things here which I think might solve that problem for you.
Okay.
One. To fill the requirements of the EAC, the registrar just has to respond. They don't have to do. They just kind of go, you know, respond. That's it. And the second thing as well is that if a registrar abuses the EAC, they would be subject to ICANN compliance. So
here's what I'm thinking. I'm a registrant. You know, I've bought a domain, you know, in good faith. 3 years later, the seller, you know, raises an issue about it. And if my registrar does not respond for some reason within 4 hours, suddenly I lose that domain. And, you know, years later. If I'm a, I, you know, I see some pushback on that.
Does anybody have any comments on that?
Well, this is Mikey.
Go ahead.
That would be an abuse.
Yeah, A, that would be an abuse, and B, if you're a domain investor and you your registrar doesn't respond in 4 hours, I think you've got an opportunity for some recourse there. And C, the real problem is the first one in the FAQ, which is if we put a date, if we say 87 days, and I'm a hijacker, then what I do is I hijack it in place. I don't disturb DNS. I don't do anything until 88 days after transfer. And the registrant is unaware that the domain has been transferred away because nothing changes until after this finite period of time. That's the real dilemma.
Yeah, I just think infinity is you know, not appropriate, not necessarily, you know,
infinity minus one provides the hijacker with the exact date to implement their hijack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I'm just very concerned we're going to get a lot. And again, my apologies to the team for not bringing this up before. I just think based on the feedback we got before, we're likely to get it again, you know, by not time-bounding this thing.
Okay, Bob, the question is this. Would how would somebody coming back to, let's just say, for example, you sell a domain on behalf of me, okay? So I give you some beautiful domain name that I have, and I ask you to broker the sale for me, okay? And you manage to find me a buyer. Under what circumstances would I be able to come back to you, like, say, a year and a half later as an emergency?
Under what legitimate circumstances?
As an emergency. This is the key thing for me.
Yeah.
I can think of a multitude of reasons why I want to come back to you and bitch and moan a year and a half later about various different things, but how would they fit into the emergency concept?
Well, yeah, we would need to define emergency, but if I were to claim hijack, then I would, you know, that would be an emergency, right?
Okay. So do you see where I'm kind of going with that?
I think so.
I mean, the point being that the problems we had in the past with a lot of this stuff was all down to, you know, seller remorse, this kind of thing, somebody feeling that they could have got a better price for a domain, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, this is the thing that I think we've done. We've discussed it to death. So, I mean, the point here is this shouldn't be an issue for the reasons already outlined. It has to be an emergency, and it shouldn't be an abuse. Okay, Barbara and then James.
I have a couple of things. One, I think maybe what we should say here is something like the time frame is consciously not defined for several reasons, and just put that, you know, any request for an EAC would be reviewed, and a determination whether or not it would be processed under this mechanism would be based on the circumstances of the incident. And then the other thing is because I do think that there could be situations where, you know, they'll go ahead and transfer the name out and let it sit idle for however long before they make a change to the DNS or what have you, in order to, you know, kind of then take control of the domain. Right now, is there any? I know there's not a requirement that the losing registrar notify the registrant that their domain has been transferred out. But I keep going back to that. It seems like, you know, if we were to send a notification to the registrant of record when the domain request for a transfer has come in, then, you know, there would be at least some additional visibility by the registrant to say, hey, what's going on with my domain because I didn't request a transfer. And at least it's a heads up for them to say, you know, there's something funny going on. Let me, you know, let me put the stop to this before it ends up being transferred away.
So you're talking about the optional email from the losing registrar to the current registrant to become mandatory. Would that be correct?
And I think at least gives the registrant the heads up that there is something going on with their domain name that they should be aware of, because, again, if somebody goes ahead and hijacks the domain name, it goes to another registrar, and they do let it just sit there for, you know, who knows, you know, a month, 2 months, whatever, before they make any other changes to the domain name, the registrant may not have any real idea that their domain name has been transferred until such time as it's not going where they expected it to. I have some domain names. You know, granted, they're not anything that's high value. I basically get my grandkids, you know, their domain name when they're born, just so that they have it in the event that they may need it in the future. But those names really, you know, nothing's really happening on them, and they're not really being used. But, you know, so I don't really monitor them that closely, and I suspect that probably even some of the domainers don't really look that closely, especially if they have a huge portfolio of domains. You know, they're not always watching to make sure that their domain name is still in their registrar account.
Okay. James?
Yes. Trying to catch this in order here. Let's go backwards. Barbara, I think that's encompassed in recommendation 5 of our report, that we would require the registrar of record or the losing registrar to notify the registered name holder when the transfer out occurs. So I think that we're on that path in a separate area of this report outside of the EAC. To Bob's concern, I agree with him that that's a concern, and maybe we can insert some clever legalese or something into the policy that says reasonable or commercially practical time frame or something that still doesn't give a hard date or a shot clock to hijackers, but at least it establishes that anyone who is using unreasonable or impractical time frames to invoke the EAC would be abusing the policy. And let's see. Now, okay, I've responded to Barbara. I responded to Bob, and I have completely forgotten why I raised my hand originally, so I'll go ahead and lower it.
It'll come back to you as soon as you put your hand down. You know that, don't you?
Probably. And to Barbara's question, it does say the word, if I'm reading Recommendation 5 correctly, the working group recommends modifying Section 3 of the IRTP to require that the registrar record losing registrar be required to notify the registrar of transfer out. The one thing that we were certain about is that we didn't want the transfer to be dependent upon that notification or any action taken by the losing registrar, but we did require the notification. So I think that we've got that part covered, and I think that we can cover Bob's concerns, which are legitimate, and I think we can cover them with some language that doesn't give the bad guys a blueprint. By using terms like reasonable or commercially practical. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, James. Does anybody else have any other thoughts on this before we move on to the comments? Or move back to the comments, rather. Going once. Going twice. Okay. Christina, if you're still alive, could you put up the comments thing onto this? Or can I do that myself? Okay, perfect, thank you. Oh, that was fast. Stop being so efficient. Right. Now, see if I can find, where are we?
Michaeli, while you're doing that, one action item that we'll probably need to do when we're all done is make the comments align with our draft. I noticed on just this first page that we talk about 24 hours when now we're down to...
That's a very good point.
Something shorter than that. So it's just a kind of report writing cleanup thing to do at the very end.
And yes, James, I will remind people, we are 5 minutes to 4. if anybody needs to drop off at 4 o'clock, but as usual, this call is scheduled for 90 minutes. So if anybody wants to drop, needs to drop off, that's perfectly okay. We won't sob too much. On with regard to the making sure everything syncs up, I think that's a kind of a bit of a housekeeping that we would need to do before on actually across the board. But which is very valid. Thank you, Mikey. Okay then. Right, let's see. I think we're up to around page 6, 32, 33. Okay, so, 31, 32, the periods and all that kind of thing. We've actually just been discussing that, so that's all been, that's done. Which issues may be raised through the emergency action channel? 33, from the registries, the criteria detailed in the ESSAC report would be a good starting point. Any comments on that? Mikey?
This is Mikey. No, I should probably take an action to run back and take a look at those. I haven't.
Okay.
The ESSAC report was actually contemplating something a bit broader than what we have got in that.
Well, that's our answer then, to say that we've narrowed it beyond, we've kept it very, very narrow.
Yeah, we could say that. I'll take an action to just run back to that report and check, though.
Okay. ICA, the AAC should, try that again slowly. The EAC should only be used for true crisis situations under a clear and narrow definition of emergency that is based upon current and reliable metrics of actual non-hypothetical instances of abuse, including those arising from fraud and deception. I think we agree with that, and we are trying to work on language within the EAC to stress that. Even actually stealing their comment would be a bad way of actually supplementing the language. The registrar stakeholder group, the nature of emergencies to be handled by a such channel must be precisely defined. We agree, and we are endeavouring to do so. From the BC and from ALAC, strange red fellows, the EAC might also be useful for issues outside the scope of this PDP, and although not in scope for consideration by this WG, should not be precluded. I think Mikey has some language in there, or James has some language in there. James, go ahead.
Yes, I think that while we should drive this to policy as part of the IRTP, you know, I can say that there's a lot of different contexts where this might be helpful and address some of the problems we're dealing, for example, in other abuse areas, UDRP, and possibly even some law enforcement issues. So this could be expanded, but I would hate to try and bite that off right now.
Okay. I think there is some language in there already, in the, either in the actual thing itself or in the FAQ, about this might, the scope of it might be expanded with other consensus policies or wording to that effect. I don't actually have that document in front of me now. Hold on.
This is Mikey. It's in the FAQ. It's not in the policy.
Okay, fair enough. Perfect. So, you know, we have considered this, but in the interests of achieving something, we decided just to limit ourselves to what we're dealing with. Okay, then. Okay, who should document the exchanges of information on the emergency action channel? From the BC, the BC defers to registries and registrars when it comes to documenting successful exchanges, as well as how those unsuccessful exchanges are documented and communicated to the registry. Thank you. That's a good comment there. I think we've kind of covered that anyway, the thing about the written record, and also these ideas we've had of discussing, kind of communicating in parallel. Who is entitled to make use of the emergency action channel from the registries? Opinions vary in the registry group. Some registries have the opinion that it should only be available to the registrant. Others are of the view that it should be limited to an authorized list of registrar and registry contacts and approved contacts of recognized security and stability-oriented groups. The registry notes that more analysis discussion is warranted. So our response is that we are limiting this to contracted parties, and somebody who is affected would need to raise the issue with their registrar and let them deal with it that way. The INTA, the EACB may be used by agreed registrants to raise the issue of hijacking or erroneous transfers. We would politely disagree and said that the registrants need to channel their issues via their registrar. GD, I assume that's GoDaddy. Is that you, James? Do you have your own little thing with your own letters?
Yeah, that's me.
Oh, you're lucky. I'm gonna start submitting things, kind of special comments, so I get a BK or something.
I think B and BK, yeah. And I think that, you know, in the context of what we've discussed, and since this was our position at the time of the comment, I think that we would now support the language as it reads in the EAC, that it would be ICANN registries, ICANN registrars, and ICANN staff.
You know, you don't seem to have anything kind of radically against it anyway in this comment. Registrars, EAC can only be the registrars and or ICANN, and notes it only supports the EAC if communication is limited between those parties to serious and urgent domain name related emergencies. Okay, which is pretty much in line with what the EAC is. The BC says the BC does not envision that registrants would have access to the EAC. And that's fine, because we're saying that they wouldn't. Now, ICANN staff have a comment. In some hijacking cases, the hijacker hacked the registrant's account with the registrar and changes the whois details to his or her own before the domain name gets transferred, which means that the hijacker is the registrant at the time that the transfer takes place. Therefore, the EAC should not be limited to the person or company that would list it as the registrant when the transfer took place. Thoughts?
This is James. That's not applicable because the registrant is not able to invoke the EAC.
Okay.
That's for the registrar to determine and then for the registrar to decide whether or not to invoke the EAC. But that's a preliminary step to an EAC.
Okay, perfect. Right then. Okay, that's the last one there. Oh no, we've got a bit more, sorry. Where are we? Okay, Charter Question B, Recommendation 4, which is on page 9, number 51. Charter Question B, Recommendation 4, all but one registry agreed with this recommendation. The one registry did not agree with the recommendation. Noted that ICANN staff and GNSO volunteers are overloaded at this time. That's more to do with work prioritization. Support for the SOT recommendation and no objections from INTA, BC, GoDaddy, and the ICA. Charter Question B, Recommendation 5. This is to do with the notification email that we were just discussing a minute ago. From the registries, all but one registry agreed with this recommendation. The registry that did not agree pointed out that notification would be a good thing, but only if the registrant is not held hostage by the losing registrar presenting misleading information. Any thoughts on that? James?
Yes, so I think that the registries and GoDaddy are saying essentially the same thing, which is that notification is good, notification should be required, but the transfer itself should not be impeded by the action or inaction of the losing registrar.
Okay. Next one from GoDaddy. Support for this recommendation as long as the transfer is not delayed or dependent upon any action on the part of the losing registrar, which we agree. Support for the recommendation from the BC. Now, child question C. The BC notes its support for requiring a lock after who is information is updated when that update affects a change of registrant. In addition to prohibiting a transfer of domain name registration for 60 days following a transfer, which is currently an option under reason of denial number 9 in the IRTP. Mikey, I presume you drafted this comment, did you?
Yeah, I did, but this language doesn't resemble my language very much. If you want, you can go to the next one, and I'll drag up the draft. I don't know what this is about. Hang on. Why don't you skip to 57 for now? And I'll...
Okay, we'll go ahead to 57. We can always come back. All right, then. Chart question C, recommendation 6. Registries. Most registries agree with this recommendation, although one registry did point out that the term reasonable must be clearly defined, as some registrants have been asked for rather onerous documentation requirements when a contact is no longer an employee / associate of the domain, and a new contact is trying to prove that they are an authorized agent for the domain. In addition, a registry recommended that the clarification needs to accommodate court orders. James, go ahead.
You know, I appreciate that we're moving on, but I wanted to go back to 56 while Mikey digs that up, because I think that this is something that I noted earlier where we had some loose ends out there, and I think that this is one of them. I don't see in our existing recommendations where we make a recommendation on a subject that I think we discussed fairly extensively, and that is currently whether or not to lock a name for 60 days after a transfer to prevent a further transfer is currently optional. And we discussed this, and I think in our most recent report we said we were looking for public feedback on this during the comment period. And number 56, I think, is the only one that came in that resembles a public comment in this area. But I think that we're missing a recommendation on charter question C needs to reflect what we believe about what we discussed as transfer hopping. So I'm going to transfer, and then 2 days later I'm going to transfer again, and 2 days later I'm going to transfer again. And we discussed a little bit about making the voluntary or optional block, which most of the larger registrars are currently using, making that required. So this is just a loose end. I wanted to flag it for discussion now or discussion before we... before we call this section done.
Okay, thanks, James. Does anybody else have any comments or thoughts?
It's James again, and I think that's what Mikey's paragraph there was referencing, the recommendation
okay.
That doesn't exist but was asked for in our public comment.
Okay. Right, where are we? Brain gone dead again. Did I manage to move the page and I'm now completely confusing myself?
This is Mikey. I have finally dug up the draft.
Yep.
We support requiring a lock after who is updated when that update affects a change of registrant. We defer to the registrars when it comes to specifying how long this interval should be, but would suggest something on the order of 60 days as a starting point. The BC also supports prohibiting a transfer of a domain name registration for 60 days following a transfer, which is currently an option under reason denial 9 of the IRTP. That's the actual language. It got sort of garbled a little bit in the translation.
Okay.
So I think it's pretty much in line with what Paul was or what James was just saying. But it took me a while to get to our draft. Sorry.
Okay. Thank you. Right. The only one thing I was going to say was the registries are looking for a clarification of the term reasonable. I'd counter and ask for a clarification of the term onerous, personally. But that's just me being awkward. 58. Support for this recommendation, sorry, INTA, support for this recommendation, but request that an exception should be considered for registrations acquired as part of a successful UDRP. Since if a change of registrant occurs after a UDRP or equivalent action, it's very likely that the domain name has been transferred back to the rightful owner, and no limitations should exist as to how long the rightful owner should be required to keep the domain name at a particular registrar. James?
Okay, so this is probably an area where we need to discuss philosophical approaches. Do we want to address this issue here, or does this need to be corrected in the language of the UDRP? You know, without getting into too much detail about how we implement UDRP decisions or how others might, I think that we've got an overlap here. UDRPs can but don't necessarily need to use the IRTP to implement the decision. I think that, we could probably say that much cleaner in the UDRP. Because if we put it in the IRTP, then we've got to build hooks for all the other processes, like, for example, URS and all the other things that might come down the road that might also want to use IRTP. Whereas if we keep the IRTP clean and then we can invoke it, with a language from other policies as needed. So I think that the response to this would be this is something that we might consider, as part of that UDRP review exercise that's being undertaken and not try to fix it in IRTP. That's just my opinion. Thank you.
Thanks, James. Anybody else?
This is Mikey. I am a bit confused. When I was writing our draft, I was thinking that recommendation number 6 has to do with locks on domain names that are consistent across all registrars versus those which are unique to a registrar, whereas the UDRP stuff that James is talking about hadn't even crossed my mind. Am I on the wrong page here?
No, Mike, I'm sorry. This is James again. You are correct, and it looks like INTA supports that recommendation, the first 4 words. And then they introduce this new problem, this new point, which is this issue of using IRTP to implement UDRP decisions.
Ah,
so
now I'm with
it's
you.
A completely
okay.
New train of thought, the rest of that comment.
Thank you.
Mikey, just with respect to the entire IRTP and UDRP, as things stand at present, the policy, in my personal opinion, and not that of anybody else, not that anybody would ever confuse my opinion with anybody else's opinion, the current policy is a bit broken, and I think the UDRP review is needed, because the way it's worded at the moment, it's as if they kind of magically expect you to transfer a domain name to somebody, even though you have no way of doing that without them actually requesting the transfer, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does make sense.
It's a little bit broken. There is no way for me to physically move a domain name to another registrar or to another registrant unless it has been requested. I can move it to another registrant within my own registrar, but obviously if I don't have their contact details, I can't do that. But there is no way for me to transfer it to another registrar without getting a request. It's impossible. I can't do it. Technically, it's impossible. I can do that in COUK, though. To kind of back up what James is saying, I agree with what James is saying. I would also add that something along the lines of, the IRTP needs to serve the entire community, not just trademark holders, that a change of control would be sufficient, or something to those lines. I mean, basically, I don't see why the hell they should have an exception to if a rule is introduced about the domains not being moved around the place. I don't see why they should have an exception just because of a UDRP. I think it's completely unreasonable, and I think it's just it's open to gaming. And it's not as if all WIPO decisions are perfect and founded on reality. So I personally don't like that, but I think, yes, putting something in that shunts it back to the part of the UDRP review. James, as you probably know the answer to this, where is that UDRP review at the moment?
I think, an initial kickoff sort of webinar workshop is scheduled for the next week or two.
Is that going to be like a PDP, a series of PDPs? I mean, what kind of form is this beast going to take on?
I don't think that's been determined yet. I think that it is, at this point, it is just it was a recommendation from the pre-PDP, the registration of use pre-PDP, to review and make sure that it's on its 10th birthday that the UDRP is still meeting everyone's needs. The webinar is occurring Tuesday, May 10th.
Okay.
And
thank you.
This is Mikey. It's a webinar to facilitate the staff's drafting of an initial report on that. So it is the beginning of a PDP process, to the extent that an initial report is the first step of that.
Probably at least one PDP.
Yeah. Back on comment 58 from the INTA, another thought we might leverage James's idea earlier in the call of revisiting this issue in a subsequent iteration of the IRTP working group, maybe E, after some of these intervening reviews and studies have taken place. So we don't lose the idea entirely, but at the same time, don't get out in front of other processes that are running in parallel.
Okay. Any other thoughts on that?
McKaylee, this is Barry.
Go ahead, Barry.
Adding to what Mikey was saying, I mean, in many ways, I could almost see kind of pushing this down the road. I wonder, is there, you know, but there's still a need to fill here. I wonder if there's a way to where we, as the Part B group, can submit maybe some sort of best practice or something so that the registrars can try using an informal EAC channel of some sort up until we do get this correct and nailed down. Just a thought. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else? Anything else on this?
This is Mikey. I guess my thought is that this is probably one we need to work on a bit more before we get done with the report. There's a pretty tasty discussion that's happened here, and we should probably put that in the work plan to finish.
Okay. Right. Moving on. We're down to about another couple of minutes. Let's try and just finish off a couple of more of these very quickly. Okay, there's a couple ones there where they're supportive. Next one. 61 from the BC, support for this recommendation, noting that it would also support elevating this recommendation from an optional best practice to a policy change that makes this kind of lock mandatory. Furthermore, the BC would also support proceeding with this change as part of this PDP. Sorry, what's recommendation 7 again? I'm completely confused. James, go ahead.
Yeah, this is James, and I think, are we still talking about, we're on recommendation 7. So, yes, I have nothing to add to Recommendation 7. I'm sorry. I thought we were still on Recommendation 6, but I see the little changeover on Charter Question B there at the bottom of page 10. So, thanks.
Okay. Anybody else have any thoughts on this? No? Okay. So I think we need to just decide one way or the other what we, what our thoughts on this is, are. Charter Question G, Recommendation 8, registries, all... Sorry? Oh, I see what he's saying. So, okay, James is saying that 50H and 59 should all be in the same section. Okay.
I'm thinking the second part of 58 is actually addressing the recommendation of number 7.
Oh, okay. So it's kind of crossover between the two.
Yes. Sorry,
it's dead on for it's really much more appropriate for this recommendation 7.
Okay. Charter Question G, Recommendation 8, all but one member of the registry stakeholder group supports this recommendation. The one registry member that disagrees noted that it must be done in accordance with any existing ICANN/registry agreement requirements. Okay. BC supports it. ICANN staff. Should the recommendation be broadened so that the WHOIS status referenced in the IRTP is consistent with the defined EPP status? For example, the IRTP refers to registrar hold, which is not defined, but client hold is a well-defined EPP status. Mikey?
This is Mikey. Sorry to drag you back to our...
That's okay.
Now that I'm following along, I just realized that the other half of our... response was to note that standardizing these messages would also improve the post-expiration domain name recovery process. So I just want to get that in the record somewhere. Thanks.
Okay. Okay, so if we were to put, if we put in that... that we'd already discussed standardizing the EPP statuses, so that maybe so this yeah it fits with that. James.
Yes. So I think I agree with the staff recommendation number 64. I think that there's probably a reason why the policy language is written in, let's call it human terms, while EPP is more machine-readable, probably so that the protocol can evolve and adapt without causing a rewrite of the policy. So perhaps maybe in light of that, the recommendation would be for staff to go and find areas where they believe policy is inconsistent with what's being displayed in WHOIS. The policy language is calling for a status of X, and there is no status of X defined in WHOIS. So maybe if we could ask them to point us in a direction where the policy is ambiguous or non-existent, and then we can fix that.
Okay. Any other thoughts? Okay. And I think that's it then. That's all, or is there another page? No,
there's
that's
just
it.
One more, and everybody supports it.
Well, I was kind of ignoring that because it was there was nothing to discuss if they all supported it. That's not true. I wasn't ignoring it. I was overlooking it. Okay, whatever. Okay then. So. We've gone through all of those. I'm going to give you back a couple of minutes of your lives. So we've got a few action items that several people need to follow up on between now and next week. Go ahead, James.
I was just going to point out that I have two action items that I will take to the list. One is discussing the concept of EAC abuse, and the other one is to discuss this loose end of the recommendation about requiring a 60-day post-transfer lock.
Okay, thank you. Anybody have any other matters they wish to raise? Okay, then. Then in that case, I will speak to you all probably next week then. Okay, thank you.
Bye, Michaela.
Thanks, bye.
Thanks, Michaela. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Michaela.